This is the Breaker.News podcast for March 4th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this episode, regular features such as the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines from around the Olympic Rim, the Big Deal feature, The Battle for Transparency and Accountability with Vincent Gogolek, and The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or did Prime Minister Justin Trudeau do more harm to himself and to Canada with that awful family vacation to India? We don't even know the final cost yet, but it did nothing to improve diplomatic or trade relations between Canada and the world's biggest democracy. How did Jaspal Attwal get inside access to the Trudeaus? Attwal tried to kill a visiting Indian cabinet minister in the 1980s, and Team Trudeau knows how to use Google, and the blowback from Attwal's involvement in the BC Liberals in 2012 should have been enough to keep him off the guest list. The Attwal scandal sparked a dramatic moment in the House of Commons last week during question period. Jim Iglinski, a Tory MP from Alberta, rose and challenged the Prime Minister. Iglinski was the cop that chased down Attwal at the scene of the crime in 1986.
The Honourable Member for Yellowhead.
Mr. Speaker, in 1986, I was one of the first officers on the scene of the shooting on Indian Minister Sidhu. I helped him and his wife into the ambulance. It's a day I will never forget. Jaspal Attwal was convicted of attempted murder in that shooting. The victims of terrorism, they have names, they have faces, and they have families. To the Prime Minister, why would he ever meet with Jaspal Attwal?
Honourable Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I thank the member opposite for his question, and I thank him for his service, as I do to all men and women who serve in uniform to keep our communities and our country safe. As I've said a number of times, the invitation never should have been extended to this individual, and as soon as we found out about it, we rescinded that invitation. The MP responsible for it has apologized, and we will continue to work to stand against violent extremism and terrorism wherever it rears its head around the world.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim, where we look at news headlines around the Olympic Rim. In the Orange County Register, Robert Niles reports, when will Disneyland have drone shows like those seen at the Olympics? Synchronized drones flew above the Olympic Stadium in Pyeongchang at the closing ceremony on February 25th. In Southern California, fireworks add to air pollution, but drones do not. In late 2016, Disney tested drones at the Disney Springs shopping area in Florida. Fireworks impress at any angle, but drone animations need to be seen head-on. Otherwise, they're a random jumble of lights. Show designers must program their shows in three dimensions. More lights and more drones. Instead of 300 at the Olympic closing ceremony, they need more like 1,000. In The Nation, Dave Zirin and Jules Boykoff report, Winter Olympic Roundup, new athletic heroes alongside the same old grifts. The Pyeongchang 2018 Games saw a big drop in TV ratings and national attention. But beneath the mountains of powdery snow and fluffy TV coverage, the reality of militarization and debt are alive in South Korea. Of the 15,000 volunteers, more than 2,000 quit because of poor living conditions, bad food, and lack of work breaks. Meanwhile, the International Olympic Committee has $1 billion in its coffers. Many stores in Pyeongchang were forced to close. The local ski shop association hung a protest banner, 2018 Pyeongchang Olympics kills us. The games were supposed to cost $6 billion, but were more like $13 billion. These games have brought extraordinary performances in the rink and on the mountain. They also showcased athletes who overcame discrimination. Gay athletes like Gus Kenworthy, Adam Rippon, and Eric Radford, African-American bobsledder Elena Myers-Taylor, and First Nations hockey player Brigitte Loquette, as well as Korean-American snowboarder Chloe Kim. In the Japan Times, demand skyrockets for sweets, masks, and sports goods popularized by Japan's Olympic athletes. Japan won 13 medals, its best ever Winter Olympics. In Hokkaido, Red Silo, or Akai Silo, cheesecake sold out every day. It was the favorite food for the bronze medal Japanese women's curling team. The flu mask worn by gold medal figure skater Yuzuru Hanyu and Japan Post stamps were also hot items. The next Winter Games are in Beijing in 2022, but before that, the Summer Olympics of 2020 are in Tokyo. And among the stories that The Breaker brought to you this week was this one. Burnaby NDP farm team flush with cash for 2018 civic election. Burnaby's NDP-leaning civic party had almost $600,000 in the bank last November, according to documents obtained by The Breaker. With less than a year until the October 20th election, the Burnaby Citizens Association had more in its dedicated election account than it spent in the 2014 election. The party, led by five-term Mayor Derek Corrigan, swept the 9-seat city council and 7-seat school board in 2014. Minutes from the conference call on November 7, 2017, show that there was $500,000 in the election account and $77,000 in the general account. By comparison, the party spent $474,000 of the $509,000 it raised for the 2014 campaign. The conference call happened the week after the NDP government tabled municipal campaign finance reform. Funds raised through October 31st can be spent in 2018 campaigns, but parties can no longer take donations from unions and corporations. Individual donations are capped at $1,200 a year to a single party or candidate. Those are headlines from around the rim for this week on the Breaker.News podcast. This is The Big Deal on the Breaker.News podcast. From time to time, we discuss issues about information and privacy rights. Freedom of information is fundamental to a democracy, and the media must guard the right of access to public records. This week, we talked to Vincent Gogolak. Vincent has been one of the most important voices in British Columbia, Canada for that matter, standing up for citizens' information and privacy rights. He has a background in both law and journalism. At the end of February, Vince retired as the executive director of the British Columbia Freedom of Information and Privacy Association.
We live in a digital age where politicians and their staff think they can delete or hide their information, which is our information, really. Governments and corporations are collecting data all about us, and sometimes they're not keeping it safe. In your years as executive director at BCFIPA, what was the biggest discovery of your career?
The fact that people were getting fewer and fewer actual records in response to FOI requests. This was back in 2012. And it was something we noticed with requests that we were putting in, and we started hearing from other people as well, I think including you, that, hey, I just put this in. There really should be something in response to this request, but I got an answer back saying no responsive records. And we went back to the government's own statistics, which thankfully they actually keep and put online, and we found that the numbers were just shooting way, way up. So things had bumped along at about 10% of requests would come back with no responsive records. And by the time we filed our request in 2012, it was up at 23%. A quarter of the requests coming back with, yeah, we don't have that, sorry, not sorry. And there's no real reason for that, and there's no obvious reason that requesters are getting dumber, or that perhaps bureaucrats, you know, they need a better vision care plan because they can't find things. But one thing that we did notice was that this started when the commissioner started reporting on timeliness of requests, because fire back a response to an FOI request saying, we can't find it, so sorry. You can get that out really quickly. So we think that this is one of the movers at this. And of course, when Commissioner Denham took on our complaint and the statistics we provide her, what she came back with was even worse. It was just amazing. The number was actually 25%, and of course, for the media, it was almost half of their requests were coming back with "can't find what you're looking for." And then she actually had the ability to go off and actually investigate, which of course we as an association, we have no powers to investigate beyond public what we can get through FOI or available statistics. And she found that deputy chief of staff, routinely deleted everything at the end of every business day. So come 5 o'clock, the bird on the stick squawks, they go yabba dabba doo and delete everything 3 times. So that's where triple deleting first came in. And the excuse given was that that everything I do is transitory in nature. I mean, that's taking sort of a very philosophical view, I guess, of these things, rather than what's written in the many government manuals that tell you what is a transitory record. Well, in this life, aren't we all really transitory? So isn't everything we do really transitory? So that was the reason given. When we came back, and this is something that we suspected was going on, now we find out that it is going on. Then 2 years later, of course, we had the commissioner's report on the triple delete scandal, where she confirmed that, yes, this is actually what they do. It's not just we are going to delete stuff that we don't want to keep around in case somebody requests it. No, if we get an actual request, we will identify the records and destroy them, which is what the triple delete scandal was about in terms of documents related to the Highway of Tears. But what was perhaps even more disturbing was the fact that the commissioner went back and looked at the premier's office again. Same premier, different deputy chief of staff. Guess what happens at 5 o'clock every day in her office? Golly gee, I delete everything because it's transitory. So you had a report from the commissioner saying, this is not what transitory means, you should stop doing it. The practice continues. Through our complaint to the commissioner, through the commissioner's 2 reports, we found out that this is actually what they are doing. This is not just a supposition on our part, other people's part, as to why information is disappearing or why records can't be found. This is why, or at least one of the reasons why, we just delete it. We get rid of it, and they confirmed that.
What was the biggest success that you experienced, that you witnessed during your time at BCFIPA?
One was the complaint we made. We actually had a number of initiatives with the Environmental Law Center at University of Victoria, where we were able to convince the commissioner to change her interpretation of Section 25. So not just to say the act, we need to, this has to be used more, the release without a request in the public interest. This needs to happen more often. There are more situations than what you're currently doing. Getting them to say, well, we need to change the act. That wasn't that hard, but the commissioner changing previous interpretations, and I don't think we've seen the full potential of this yet. For a long time, the government was using what they called out of scope of your request to remove information. They would take a chunk of a document that was responsive to your request. So you asked for the binder on whatever. They find the binder, and then they would take out chunks of it saying, oh, this isn't what you asked for. Now, that's nowhere in the Act. The Act provides all kinds of reasons that they have to show that allow them, for various societal interests, to jail free card. So we made arguments in a case that we had, the commissioner followed, or the commissioner actually, her adjudicators in a number of cases, including ours, looked at the interpretation of the act and said, you know what, you're right, that's nowhere in the act. The proper reading of the act is you respond to people. You have to find a section if you're going to try and remove stuff. The Ministry of Child and Family Development actually, in one of their submissions, in one of the cases, said they used this artificial creation in 25% to 40% of the requests that they received, and they can't use that anymore. So that will be huge. We don't know. There's no way of telling how much more information is coming out as a result of this. But that is a huge improvement, especially for people who aren't familiar with the system, who get a response back and go, they didn't give me that because it's out of scope of my request. Oh, okay, I guess I don't get that.
So where does the battle go from here? What needs to be done? Is duty to document, which was promised by the NDP, not delivered, including large monetary fines for hiding records or not making records, is that the next big battle it needs to be won?
I think it is. And this is something that has to be fought at the national level as well. Scott Bryson brought in an Access to Information Amendment Act, which goes in the opposite direction. The now former commissioner of Information Commissioner in Ottawa, Suzanne Legault, said, you know, I'd rather stick with the system we have than what you're bringing in. And conspicuously, there was no duty to document, despite the commissioner calling for it, despite the, all the commissioners, you know, the commissioners assembled, all called for a legislative duty to document in the act so that the neutral third party, the commissioner, will be able to examine this and have an entree into what's going on. And this is going to be the big battle. Now, of course, BC is going to be a center of this because of what's happened here in the past. It has been shown to have been happening. We are getting rid of things in advance, and we are prepared to actually delete things. And of course, penalties are a part of that. That if you are, in the case of the triple delete with Mr. Gretas, the only reason that he was faced with going to court was because he actually denied doing it. If he'd showed up on day one, on the first time he was called to the commissioner's office, and he swears on whatever he would be swearing on to tell the truth, and they'd ask him, so we've heard that you triple deleted a whole bunch of records after they were requested on our FOI. Is that true? If he said, yes, that's exactly what I did, and I believe we're done here now, there would have been no sanction. And that's wrong. That shouldn't be happening. There needs to be disincentive for people to do this. It doesn't have to be. Conviction and jail time doesn't even have to be likely, but there has to be the possibility that, okay, if I do this, bad things could happen to me. That'll discourage people from doing it.
That's Vince Gogolak, the retired executive director of the British Columbia Freedom of Information and Privacy Association. You can find BC FIPA online at fipa.bc.ca. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of British Columbia's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the media, the people, and the governor of the state of Washington. When Washington's state lawmakers voted to hide their email and other records from the public, the media rallied the public to contact their lawmakers. Washington's Freedom of Information law is straightforward. It says that the people in delegating authority do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The Seattle Times published a rare front-page editorial blasting Senators Nelson and Schosler, who sponsored a bill that showed contempt for public process. Said the editorial, "A government that thinks it knows best is the worst kind of government." Governor Jay Inslee finally vetoed the law, Senate Bill 6617. Media and citizens everywhere, including British Columbia, should take notice. This is how we should remind the government who the real boss is. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Well, that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for March 4th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. That's bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until the end of March, support The Breaker through Patreon and you will receive a free copy of my ebook, Red Mittens and Red Ink, The Vancouver Olympics. Again, that's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.